Welcome to the Regent Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined by my co-host, AC, who's going to take us into the episode.
On this episode, we have Robbie Sansom, who is the co-founder and CEO at Force of Nature Meats. Force of Nature is supporting regenerative agriculture through its line of regeneratively focused meats that nourish our bodies, our soil, and our future. In this episode, we learn about Force of Nature's origin story, how vastly different their products are from mainstream meat, and how they're sparking a regenerative revolution through transparency and storytelling. Robbie is truly one of the most articulate people I've met in the regenerative space, and he does an amazing job of both unpacking the complexity of the problems our current agricultural system is reckoning with and the regenerative solutions for them. Super excited to share this episode with you all. Let's dive in. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Regen Brands Podcast. We are very, very excited today to have Robbie from Force of Nature Meats. So welcome, Robbie.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me, guys. It's good to be here.
For sure, man. We love what you do. Love the brand. Love the noise you're making in the industry. For those who are not familiar with Force of Nature, give us a quick lay of the land. What do you make? You know, how many SKUs do you have, and where can people find you today from like a distribution perspective?
Well, there's no short answer to that, but I'll be as brief as I can. I'm sure the trailing hour or so will probably elaborate more on that very same answer, but. Force of Nature is a brand in the meat category offering meats in different forms, whether that's raw ground meat and steaks and those awesome cuts, already pre-cooked sausages, and whether it's for breakfast or dinner or lunch. We're launching hot dogs here soon, so we basically have all the types of protein you want for different meals throughout the day, and then we offer a variety of proteins as well. So from the traditional poultry and beef type items, as well as non-traditional exotics, which are some of the fastest, most popular growing proteins out there, from venison, elk, wild boar, which are incredible invasive species, and all of those animals and sourcing standards that we have are coming from pasture raised, 100% grass fed ranches, or they're wild harvested, or they're truly fully regenerative. In the case of our beef and our bison, and then we offer all of that in an omni-channel capacity. So for the average person, what the heck does that mean? you can find us at about almost 20,000 store shelves across the country and retail outlets.
Wow.
You can hop onto our website, order, and we'll ship it to your door anywhere in the contiguous U.S. And then there's a handful of restaurant chains. Like Hop Dotty, as an example, that really care a lot about sourcing regenerative proteins and offering the best quality food for their customers, and you can find us in those outlets as well. And so, what that really effectively allows us to do is lower the hurdle for consumers who want to support these food systems. Right? Before we started this company, and I'm sure we'll get into it, it was more challenging than it needed to be to really drive solutions at scale. For a consumer to find and support regenerative systems, right? They were out there, no doubt. And there's incredible producers and groups trying to drive the sort of change we all want to see. But there was a huge burden and learning curve for the consumer to educate themselves, scour their community, trying to find where there may be access to these things, and then vet the actual standards themselves, and then do that times every protein, right? And we were like, wait a minute. That barrier is way too high for the average consumer. How do we make it so easy for them that they almost have to go out of their way to avoid sourcing regenerative proteins? And so that's sort of where we're at, right? We're everywhere a consumer is with the types of proteins they want, how they like to buy it. We want to make it easy to connect those consumers, to the other side of our mission, which is working with land stewards and producers and processors and different regions across the country and globe, to create these supply networks that connect the good actors, the heroes on the front lines producing this food, with the consumers that are excited about supporting those systems and value what they get out of those systems. And so really we're connecting the folks on the front lines on both ends, right? The consumers who have been underserved right. and misled, with the producers who have, frankly, are in a hopeless situation, losing their land at rapid pace and stuck in a system that is punitive to their very existence, trying to offer alternatives for both. So it's a big task.
Yeah, man. It's beautiful though. It's like a beautiful piece of infrastructure building to let those two ends just do what they want to do, which is eat great food and make great food. You know, those people don't really want to do all the extra other stuff that we're forcing them to do in the current system. The wild boar is phenomenal. So that was definitely my favorite thing that I've tried that I wasn't exposed to before being a Force of Nature customer. And the D2C customer experience is also great, just for anyone out there that wants to give that a whirl. Robbie, you guys, absolutely. You guys have a seasoned team. This is kind of your second go around in the CPG space, guided by, a really successful run with Epic. So just maybe take us through kind of that journey with Epic and then how that turned into Force of Nature, just to give some folks the background there and how that's all evolved over the years.
Yeah. Again, I'll try to be brief to condense a decade into a sentence.
We got time.
No, I mean, the beauty of Epic, Katie and Taylor were the co-founders of Epic. And they are my co-founders now in Force of Nature. And I joined them at Epic when we had like three products and were a few months old. And the three of us built it together. At the time I joined, they had just transitioned from being, vegans and running a vegan energy bar company to having gone through an experience of health issues, GI issues, inflammation, joint issues, to a pretty significant degree. Katie has been seeing specialists and was really struggling. She was a high performance athlete. Was like, I'm doing all the things. I'm doing everything they say on television and in the mainstream media and the public, the narrative out there of vegan, raw food, vegan, juicing, and I'm just getting worse. And eventually got guidance like, hey, you should probably introduce healthy animal-based proteins back in your diet, see how that does. And it was like a light switch, right? Almost instantaneous recovery and turnaround of those symptoms. And so they pretty much were like, hey, we need to reincorporate these proteins in our offering. We got to move away from this plant-based strictly business and move into, that was the dawn of Epic, right? And so we were able to grow that. And it was early on in, the paleo, that which turned into, it's kind of transitioned into keto. Yeah. And now maybe in some ways carnivore. At the time though, it was the front edge of that. Nobody was really talking about grass-fed, let alone regenerative, but these vegan ideals, those values still persisted, right? I mean, what conscious and intentional living person doesn't find some recognition of value for welfare of animals, for stewardship of land and maintenance of natural systems, for human health, right? So as Epic was being born, it was, okay, well, if we're going to have a meat-based item, how do we make sure that it is improving those systems and not degrading them, as meat is often vilified for doing, right? And that became really clear, that pasture-raising animals and feeding them diets they evolved to exist on, and letting them express evolutionary behaviors and live in systems that would be evolutionarily consistent with their breed and species and lifestyle, addresses all of those factors to the point of not only mitigating issue, but driving solutions. And we call that regenerating. And then, of course, regenerative agriculture. We partnered up with Savory Institute very early on, as we were all kind of up and coming together. And that was just the rabbit hole that took us down regenerative agriculture. So Epic grew. We were fortunate enough to sell that to General Mills. And that was a very intense time for us. It was like, how do you do this? You don't start a small company that's mission-based and values-driven with the intention to sell it to, a large Fortune 500, big food conglomerate, that the average natural product consumer might call the enemy, right?
Yeah.
And so for us, that process was very interesting, because we held that same limiting belief and preconceived notion towards who and what a transaction like that might represent. And ultimately, they came to the table with not wanting to adulterate the product, not exiting any members of our team or our supply chain network, who literally are families that bet the farm on us. and telling us like, hey, you don't get it. What y'all are doing is working. We actually want you to influence and change us, not the other way around. And so that transaction, you know, went through, and then for 3 years we ran the brand there to carefully steward that handover department by department, process by process. And they fulfilled, you know, they followed through, on their commitment up to and including the whole deal almost fell apart as a result of our insistence on the value and benefit of regenerative agriculture. And it was so misunderstood and unknown. Mm. They thought that we were just a bunch of cavalier Texans out making, unfounded claims. Where clearly cattle must be evil, and to say that they could be part of a solution would expose them to false advertising across their entire portfolio. Wow. And how could they acquire this brand that could jeopardize the value of Cheerios or any of the million?
What year is this?
This is 2015 and into 2016. And we took them out to Regenerative Ranch, and the deal came through. And then within the first year and a half post acquisition, they had, you know, fully done an about face on their position with regenerative agriculture, and became the first Fortune 500 company to make a commitment to convert a significant portion of their supply chain to regenerative agriculture. And in their case, that's 1 million acres. Following them was then Danone, then PepsiCo, then many others, right? And so, you know, that was a huge moment for us, for this movement. And I think a recognition that like, hey, these, you know, small up and coming emerging brands are really powerful and we do important things, but the only way that ever manifests into real change is at scale. And so there has to come a point in some way, shape or form where there's that moment where we collaborate with an organization that can support these missions at scale. And we recognized where, though nothing is perfect, there is massive progress that can occur. And that's the avenue and path for it. So anyway, really excited about that transaction. As far as Force of Nature goes, we kept hoping in that 3 year period before, you know, we kind of had fully completed the transition that somebody would obviously pick up the baton and torch and start a regenerative based meat company. And again, there's companies out there, particularly in beef or particularly in, you know, different proteins or just regionally great. There's just amazing people out there. So I don't mean to claim that we're the first. We're just the first to in all of this at the scale and bring brand forward and bring content based and education based as well. And nobody really checked the box at scale to make it again easy for consumers, right? And so knowing how challenging it is to live in the startup world and drive a business, we weren't really enthusiastic about doing it again. We didn't need to do it again. But honestly, we felt like it was a responsibility. Like, you know, we were uniquely positioned with a set of skills and experience. We'd sort of already built a supply chain. We were very well educated on regenerative ag and the limitations and the opportunities. And it just needed to be done. And so we said, you know what, we'll do it. And if nothing else other than we raise more awareness and kick the door open for somebody else to finish the job, so be it. But like, we're committed to doing our very best to finish the job ourselves. And so, you know, 3 years after that sale, we started Force of Nature. And that was, you know, early 2019. And here we are today. You know, it's been a wild ride. It still is.
Crazy.
It's beautiful, man. And I think the General Mills thing to me is we fall into that misconception, like you said, of all big is not bad. And ultimately, you know, those folks are going nowhere. And if we don't help them get better, you know, we're not going to really change anything. So I love that y'all took that approach, and it sounds like they were extremely collaborative. And, you know, I haven't strung together the pieces like you did about kind of them being the first domino to fall on the big commitments. But like, if that doesn't happen, you know, who knows? And basically that empowers the rest of the ecosystem to kind of work towards that North Star and take that action. So it's just amazing that all happened from, you know, y'all trying to sell a better, really meat snack, you know, beef stick, or I forget the exact first item, but I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, it is. And you know, again, I don't want to take credit for being the catalyst, right? This has been a multi-decade, multi-generation long movement. And I think we've certainly played a role in it. And if anything, maybe helped be an accelerant for certain parts of it. But I think, you know, we're not alone. And I'm so encouraged by the overwhelming buildup of different parties and different service groups and different organizations and brands. And it's just like more and more people show up every day in masses to try to be a part of the solution and play a role where diverse roles are needed to help bring, you know, awareness to these issues and offer better solutions for consumers and, you know, address the myriad of challenges that our current agriculture system has created. And so, you know, we're a part of that and we're proud to be a part of it. And we're going to do the best we can, but we're definitely not alone, fortunately.
Yeah.
That's huge. So, you know, one of the things we try to focus on the podcast is hoping to kind of like peel behind the curtain and help our listeners understand, you know, what makes Force of Nature regenerative? What are they doing differently compared to other, you know, protein producers in the industry? So curious to get your take, like pick one or two of your favorite proteins that you offer and explain to the consumers, like, what is it that you, how is your sourcing different from the majority of beef, bison, boar? I mean, I don't know how many of the people are doing wild boar and whether or not it could ever not be regenerative, but just walk us through what that looks like from your end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the first thing is like, what is the majority, what's the challenge? Oof, God, this is a long what's the challenge with the existing system, right? Why do we exist and what are we trying to create awareness to and then change? And I think there are so many things that the current system is doing that creates issues that need to be addressed, right? And I think if you'll give me the grace for some length here, I think one is agriculture at general is concerning. It's not it's not just animal agriculture. Plant agriculture should not be getting a free pass. Plant agriculture is a scourge on the earth, right? And by all means, like it's been, you know, for 10,000 years since the agriculture revolution, and then in the last couple of generations with the green revolution, I think the intention has been, you know, how do we support societies? How do we create food? How do we avoid starvation, which would have plagued our species for millennia, and even still does in some places, but not anywhere near to the degree and the footprint it would have. But you know, what have the trade-offs been? And it's been, you know, desertification of like 70% of our fertile lands across the globe. It's been the loss of topsoil globally. And the topsoil is this tiny, tiny, tiny thin layer that stands over the crust of the earth that takes 500 plus years for nature to build, that is finite. And we are losing it at rapid paces. And when it's gone, we lose the ability to sustain life, terrestrial life largely, because the microbiology in that soil supports the plant and the animal life on that ground level, which supports the herbivores and omnivores, which feed the carnivores, which all die and go back into the, so like loss of topsoil is a major threat to our existence and all existence of all life. You can add in pollinator die off. You can add in dead zones in oceans. You can add in atmospheric carbon. People think that cow burps are the challenge or the reason we have an atmospheric carbon issue. 40% of the legacy load of carbon in the atmosphere is the result of tilling ground for planting crops. Right? We're all carbon-based life. The ground is alive. It is full of organic matter if it is healthy soil. And when you turn that over, it oxidizes and releases carbon into the atmosphere. And so, you know, the carbon issues lead to ocean acidification issues. I mean, I just keep going on, right? Droughts, floods, food security, and so on. So like these are massive challenges, right? We need to understand that the common denominator in all of this is our agriculture system, right? A system that tills a lot, a system that destroys these land bases and doesn't rebuild them. It's extractive. A system that requires a lot of chemical amendments, you know, the herbicide, fungicide, pesticide, all that goes into waterways. We got glyphosate showing up in breast milk and the majority of people's urine now, just because they're spraying highly toxic cancer causing disruptive agents directly onto the surface of our food. These are all things that we want to be known and talked about, especially at a day and time when the average age of our population is in decline, which is shocking, right? I mean, we should be extending life, not shortening it. Particularly in animal-based systems, there's a lot of criticism, and I think a lot of challenge, right? So going back to the origin of the question, what might a typical supply chain for beef look like? And again, beef is, you know, chicken is kind of king now, but beef's been king for a long time and still up there with poultry. And it would look like an animal being raised on you know, born on a cow calf operation. So a bunch of cows, they have a handful of calves. as soon as they can wean those animals as quickly as possible, probably earlier than they should be weaned for optimal health and wellness and quality of life, they'll go to another operation to try to gain weight as quickly as possible. And that'll generally be by confining them in some form to limit their activity, to limit their calorie burn, and offering them grains, because grains have the same impact on animals that they do on us. They fatten you up. It's a lot of carbs, mm-hmm. and you put on a lot of intermuscular fat, or AKA marbling, which, you know, for us would be a sign of chronic disease, and for the USDA is a sign of premium, which is kind of bizarre.
That's a really great way to frame that. Man, I love that.
And it's funny because America's standard for that is sort of scoffed at around the rest of the globe, right? They put a different premium on flavor and terroir and, you know, all sorts of other things besides just like how fat is it. But other than Japanese, they love their fat. And then, you know, it'd certainly finish its life in a feedlot, right? Highly confined, again, getting a certain regimen. And most of these animals will be harvested between 20 and 30 months, right? They're very young, probably closer to 20 months, right? Particularly in beef. And so, you know, it's kind of a sad sedentary existence. You know, it's very industrialized, meaning it's almost like they're widgets in a machine. And frankly, the producers are cogs in that wheel. You know, they're not thriving in this environment. They're trying to figure out how to make their ends meet. And there's some large government interests and large corporate interests that make it very, very difficult for them. They borrow and borrow and borrow and eventually lose their land. And, you know, at the turn into the 1900s, you know, maybe a quarter of the population were farmers, and now it's probably 2.5 or 3%. We lose 5 or 10,000 farms a year, and Bill Gates somehow can manage to buy their land, but these families that have been doing it for five generations can't afford to stay on their land. So we've created this paradox that makes no sense, right? Our neighbors are no longer producing our food, and it's even the land base is falling into, you know, some profit motivated corporate interests. And there you go. You know, you have really cheap, sad, sedentary animals that turn into food that is celebrated for its cheapness, right? We say commodification is a celebration of price above all else at the expense of all else. And all of those shortcuts and all of those, unilateral compromises have led to being able to produce food in a super hyper efficient system, right? I mean, we do a lot of cattle in a small location and very, very quickly. And again, it's so efficient, it's brittle, it's fragile. You guys saw that during COVID when one plant shut down and all of a sudden we had an excess supply of meat and excess demand for meat simultaneously. Retail shelves were empty and farmers were having to euthanize animals because of one plant going down, right? What a screwed up system and an outcome that highlights a security issue, a stability issue that we should never be seeing here, right? You know, the other thing is we have a farm bill, that puts hundreds of billions of dollars into prop up this system. You know, much of that going into, you know, kind of food stamp programs, but a lot of it going into supporting this monocrop agriculture production of super cheap corn and soy. And with super cheap corn and soy, you can overproduce it. You can control the world supply of it. You can put it into every food in the grocery store and you can feed animals on it. And make every system dependent on it. And that foundational layer for every one of those systems makes it really cheap, even though it causes harm. The production of those grains causes harm to the land. It causes harm to the farmers in those communities. Farmer suicide, I just mentioned, is higher than the suicide rate of veterans returning from war. I mean, what a hopeless reality to be in. And then it leads to really, really, really cheap food on the shelf. And that cheap food on the shelf may have a low sticker price, but it has a high cost. And it's relatively, I don't want to say valueless, right? Meat is better than anything else. However you can get it, eat meat, right? But there's a huge cost to this commodified, subsidized, cheap meat that is deferred. And human health and health of land and well-being of like social issues, well-being of humans and community and your own, the welfare of those animals and so on. And that isn't reflected in that price. And I would argue if it was reflected in that price, you would probably double or triple it. So they're short of a representation of what in a nutshell, the existing conventional system is. And to compare that to one of our supply chains, we'll look at bison, right? You know, these animals, some of these animals are coming from land, from huge land masses where those bison themselves are being managed exactly to the best of our limited ability, to emulate how bison would have impacted the land through the millennia since they were here. You know, I mean, these animals are keystone species, keystone meaning they have a disproportionate and necessary impact on their broader environment. So there would have been millions of bison roaming in herds from Mexico to Canada, trampling on the ground, unselectively grazing everything, leaving relatively quickly, and in their wake, fertilizing with their, you know, their manure and irrigating with their urination and providing wallows, which would be habitat for certain species and all this kind of stuff. Again, this beautiful, elaborate circle of life and dance and balance and equilibrium. And they made it, they wouldn't come back for months at a time, right? So in our partner ranches, they're moving the bison around. They're allowing them to have that impact. They're doing those things. The bison are living longer. They're not being weaned early. They're not being sent to feedlots to fatten up. And even we're measuring the impact on those land bases. Is the water cycle improving? Is it making more effective use of rainfall? Is it storing in its soil? Is the soil organic matter and soil life improving? Is it increasing over time? Is it holding capacity for water improving? Is biomass increasing? Is insect species improving? And bird species improving? And other animal native wildlife improving? And on down the list of things you can look at and measure both empirically, scientifically, and anecdotally. Up to and including, in some cases, partner ranches are setting aside habitat for endangered species, ground nesting owls and black-footed ferrets, and in partnership with universities and the federal government, right? Trying to create food while also restoring native systems, which is how it can be done and how it should be done, you know?
Right.
And then ultimately producing healthy animals that are thriving themselves in thriving ecosystems, being part of a solution and truly replacing a vicious system with a virtuous one, where those animals fulfill their potential on the land, as a species, and then eventually make it back into the food supply, which we all do. We're all part of the food supply for other living. It takes life to sustain life. And then we celebrate the role those animals played while living, and then we celebrate the role those animals played as part of our food supply, nourishing our bodies, and we tell their stories and we honor what that is when it's in the package and prior to being in the package. And so I think that's probably the most succinct juxtaposition I can give between what we're trying, the best example of what we're trying to do compared to the worst example of what exists. But the truth is, the worst example of what exists is the overwhelming majority. We'll call it 99.9% of ruminant protein is coming from that system. And the big challenge in all of this is the system plays such wicked games with consumers, right? Putting a brand on something so-and-so farms where so-and-so farms doesn't exist, right? Or calling it natural. What a joke is the natural claim. There's no real definition. Everything came from this earth. It's just a way to pull the wool over a customer's eyes. Vegetarian fed claims on pork and poultry, right? The only way you get that is if you have a curated and controlled food supply. They don't have access to the outdoors where they could forage, and omnivores can't eat an omnivore diet. I mean, we've convinced ourselves it's a positive claim when really it should be a red flag. It's just been one lie after another in that food system. And I think the average consumer overwhelmingly believes that the system that they're supporting is markedly different than it is. Because they try to buy organic, or they try to buy something that says grass fed. And the truth is, you can be organic and you can be grass fed coming off of a feedlot, doing all of the things that we just said were challenges. Is it better than the most conventional? Certainly. We're on a spectrum here, right? But 100% grass-fed, pasture-raised, regenerative is absolutely the gold standard, and it encompasses so many necessary things. And I think what we are offering is the manifestation of what consumers want want to support, value, and would prefer to believe their food is coming from, but they have been shielded from that reality. The wool's been pulled over their eyes. And frankly, they've been complicit in supporting a system that's frankly counter to their intention and counter to their values, right? What is more upsetting than to think of a consumer going to a store, looking at packages with intention and paying a premium because they see a claim that they think is representative of something that it is not? That's fucking bullshit. And that is pervasive in this industry. And so that's part of what we're here to do, is to create awareness, create education, create access. And my job isn't to say, hey, you were wrong. If you think that system is great, you're wrong for thinking that and you're wrong for supporting it. Honestly, I don't agree with you, but I believe in your right to have your opinion. I just think in order to form your opinion, you need to have transparency and access to the truth. And that's been shielded, right? That's only been shielded. It's been concealed. And I think as we can open consumers' eyes up, many, if not most, will gladly support a system that is transparently representing what they see value in. And that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to create awareness and give choice. And it's working. Yeah.
That was the Regen Brands manifesto right there. That was like exactly why we do this work. You did it better than we could ever have done it. So thank you. And it's beautiful and very well said. Curious if you could touch for those that don't know kind of about Savory and EOV, and like, you know, there's this very pervasive like plant-based versus animal-based, all animal ag is bad, but talk about Land and Market and EOV and just kind of how y'all are proving that like these are the natural systems. These are doing, they're having all these positive benefits. Cause I think the average consumer just needs more information there.
Yeah, totally. And I want to be transparent too, right? I think this is a big challenge when we talk about ideals. Not every single thing that we produce has a regenerative claim on it. If it says regenerative on our package, which our beef and bison do, it's fully regenerative. Poultry's a little different. We have our own podcast called Where Hope Grows. We did a whole episode on why and what our poultry supply is, right? You know, venison, elk, they're 100% grass-fed, pasture-raised, but we're working, and it doesn't matter what our system is. We're transparent about it. We're working to raise the bar. We don't believe there's a destination you can race to and dig your heels in. We believe in raising the bar every year. We believe in celebration and progress over perfection, but we should be pursuing perfection. And that standard should be raising every year as well. So we don't have EOV on all of our products. We have a lot of supply that is EOV, but we may not have it on the package. And there's a handful of more complicated reasons for that when it comes to building a brand and scaling and supply and the costs of these third party verifications. None of that is cheap, right? And the more little circles and emblems you put on a package, the more expensive it is to produce for the producer, and harder it is for a brand to build a supply chain for, and more costly ultimately it is for the consumer with the reduced supply. So we're trying to build a brand that stands for all of those things, that has integrity and transparency and value, and absolutely limit the number of seals that we have on the package from to make it easier for consumers and for producers who are to be rewarded by the system. With Savory and EOV in particular, we started that building that with Savory, you know, almost back in the early days of Epic. So it's been nearly a decade ago. The idea was organic is great, but we need, you know, regenerative is better. We need a standard. We need a ubiquitous gold standard to validate, because greenwashing occurs, and it will occur for regenerative, and it's starting to occur. And there are varying opinions on what is and isn't greenwashing and to what extent we're seeing that, but something will have to rise to the top to hold folks in the supply chains accountable and give confidence for consumers who don't have the time or energy to be highly educated experts on every single thing that there is. And so, you know, that's what EOV and Land to Market really are attempting to do. EOV is the Ecological Outcome Verification Protocol that the Savory organization has put together to measure outcomes on land such that empirically we can substantiate regeneration is happening. And I can dive into that. But basically, they go on the land on varying intervals and measure across all different aspects and variables to come up with a score that says, yep, this land base is getting better every year as a result of what's going on it. And Land to Market then is the seal that you can put on that package. to say like, hey, this is Lambda Market verified. You know, we are verifying that it meets our standard and this protocol and is producing these outcomes. So that is, that's Savory EOV and Savory Lambda Market. Rodale Institute has a different one. It's called Regenerative Organic. It's more like the organic standards. Savory is outcomes based. It's measuring outcomes. The Rodale version is practices based. It's limiting what you can do to ideally drive outcomes through practice. Savory is more flexible. It helps with all the, you know, it's sensitive to all the eco regions. What's possible in one climate is different. You know, what's possible in a rainy, grassland that gets great precipitation and fertile soil is way different than in an arid desert area, right? And so trying to two different approaches. Now there's more and more coming on every day. Regenified is another one that's coming up and coming. And so,
yeah,
you know, again, like going back to force of nature, right? Like right now, our standard is either you are one of those three, or we have gone out to your ranch and done our own indexing and protocol. And we have some verifiers ourselves that go onto the land to do that. But we haven't hitched our wagon solely to one. It gives us the opportunity to access more supply and to support more good actors on the front line of the land bases without having limitations or unnecessary hurdles as we're just trying to connect these folks to consumers with the most integral product and process with as few hurdles as possible. So one day somebody will rise to the top. It will be a little greenwashed, and then the next thing will take its place. But you know, we're on a journey there, and in the meantime, we're trying to support everybody that's doing work in that on that path, and try to be as honest and transparent as we can with what we are doing. And again, we're not perfect. Now, happy to dive into where and why, and we put it on our website, and we'll tell stories. But I think that's just really important for folks to understand. I think that to me might be to end this once again a long diatribe of mine. That might be the thing I would encourage folks to do. You know, claims, the majority of them are out to the highest bidder. Anybody with a checkbook can make just about any claim on any product. Meats, no exception. Plants are no exception. Mm-hmm. Like, if they have something that they're excited to show you, they will show you. Yeah. If they have something to conceal from you, they will make a claim and not be transparent after that.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm not going to name any names, but there are large brands out there sold in large natural retailers that are bullshit. There are large brands out there that do direct to consumer sales that make grass fed type claims and pasture raised type claims that are bullshit. You know.
Yeah.
Start with the claim and let that be the point where you say, okay, they meet the minimum bar. Let me dig in. Let me see what they're actually doing that they're proud of, the stories they're telling, the human beings they're working with, the impact they're having. And then I'll vet whether or not those claims are substantiated or not. And I would suggest, sadly, the majority of the time, it's active, aggressive greenwashing. Marketing machines doing their job to perpetuate the status quo of taking advantage of consumers' desires to take shortcuts and use claims to get a short-term win.
Yeah. Y'all have done a phenomenal job on the marketing and messaging side, right? The direct to consumer execution, the website, the social, but I'm curious, just strictly retail, right? And we have such a short amount of time. I know y'all have done some like really cool freezers for some retailers. I'm sure you've tried lots of things on the merchandising side. The packaging's obviously very strong, but like what has really worked? Because this regenerative thing is big. It's complex. You know, these are not things that you can get across in the 2 seconds that somebody's looking at that package of meat. So like, how have y'all thought through that and what has really been effective there?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? There's so many complicated layers to all of this and how we as consumers have been conditioned to think meat should be cheap, conditioned to think these falsities that we don't question. And then whenever we're faced with a different perspective, we're like, oh shit, wait a minute, that is different. It doesn't make a ton of sense. I think in retail in particular, there's an interesting backstory that's important to understand. Grocery stores want to drive traffic into their stores. You know what I mean? Like they're nothing without shoppers walking in the door. And historically speaking, the top drivers of traffic are access to quality protein, access to quality produce, and price. the origin story and the original intention of Whole Foods would have been quality protein and produce and products, right? The, you know, Walmart would be the price, you know, sort of classic example of, you know, how do we make things as cheap as possible? Now, of course, Amazon, which is interestingly now connected with Whole Foods. And there's things happening there that are fascinating. But, you know, again, it's an evolution. It doesn't mean bad or good. It just means different. And how do we all approach it and play our role to the best of our ability? But grocery stores, in order to drive that foot traffic on access to quality protein, you know, they want to have private label brands. That's why you see all of the, you know, every grocery chain has their own version of their own branded products that they own the supply chain for. Mm-hmm. Because then they can make sure they're the only ones that offer it. And they can say, hey, this is the best product out there. You can only get it here. And they do that with their meat. And the other way that they do that is the service case, right? The unbranded meat in the back of the store, mm-hmm. where you have a service case and a butcher and a person there to talk to that you can make a relationship with. And it's great. I mean, I'm not to say it's great that we have that selection, that opportunity, but when you do it that way, you lose the truth. You lose the story behind the food. What farmer did it come from? How was that animal treated? How did it live its potential? What impact did it have? What else is there to the story besides the claim? Because again, the claim is just scratching the surface. There's so much more. And the truth is, many retailers, it doesn't matter whether you're going to one competitor or another, they're getting their meat from the same place. It's like Tyson, it's KFS, it's, you know, the big guys. And those guys they have their 100% grass-fed items. You know what I mean? Like they have their items that, you know, are meeting all the minimum bars and standards to make a claim. And so it's been interesting as the center of the grocery store has evolved, right? All of a sudden, mm-hmm. we went from like, hey, packages are convenient. You can make food in a minute and you can do all these things and it's fortified. And then I think we realized, oh no, this has gone wildly awry. And then brands in the center of the grocery store started coming out with values and missions and, hey, we're better for you in this regard. And we're not putting this in here and we're donating to this cause. And, you know, people began to form a relationship with their food again. And then that slowly expanded and began to permeate into the perimeter of the store, which is the commodities. You saw that with dairy, and then you saw it in milks, and then you saw it in eggs. And I think meat is still a frontier where it hasn't yet happened. But in order to have a brand like Force of Nature on the shelf that tells that story, that consumers can actually form a relationship, not just with the brand, but with the food and the animals and the people raising the animals through our content and transparency, that's sort of revolutionary in this section of the grocery store. A long way around to get back to your question about what's working and what's not. A lot of grocery stores have what's called a clean door, clean floor, clean store policy. They only want their stuff. They only want their branding, their promotions, their red stickers. They don't let you do anything to stand out. So it starts with your package. What stands out on your package? Because that's all you get to do to tell your story. It better be an effective job. And so I think our team's done a wonderful job of branding and imagery and romance copy on the package, website, you know, driving awareness through our digital work and content to, you know, prior to getting into the store or following up from the store, more points of exposure for consumers. I think where we have been able to chip away at and convince retailers to let us have an off shelf, put a branded freezer and put clean freezer clings that tell a story, create QR codes that lead to custom landing pages, take more of our products. We have more real estate telling more story. We've been able to see more and more success. But I mean, it's really all of that is really trying to reverse again some of the convention and conditioning of the system of, you know, being brands not really exist. I mean, like, you know, again, if I were to ask, it's different today, but it's funny when we started this company, if I was to ask somebody, what's your favorite brand of meat? They'd get stumped. They'd be like, what do you mean? What do you mean? It's like, I shop at this store. Right. And that's sort of a symptom of what that system was. But with brands coming forward and consumers selecting for brands, they're able to choose to align their values with the values of the brands. And that's what they're looking for. And so I think grocery stores are seeing that. I think they're also seeing that as meat is under attack, the conveniences and the shortcuts that the prior system had taken is going to begin to expose them. So they need to begin to build an alternative set. I think as younger shoppers, you know, the millennials and whoever, whatever the heck the new name for the generation after that might be as the data constantly changes. you know, 80 something percent or more are looking for better for me, better for the environment, better for welfare. And so they know the consumer of the future is looking for these things. And so they're all consciously recognizing of the shortcomings of where they've been, the opportunity going forward, the necessity. And, you know, it's going, I think it's going to work itself out, but we're going to definitely continue to try to, be a catalyst for that. And certainly, an adjutant that kind of helps push the momentum and make it an accelerant, I should say, to make it go a little faster.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned a lot of the challenges here with, you know, the certification space right now, the challenges in conveying these branded meat values to consumers at retail. You know, if you could wave the regenerative magic wand, per se, and change the way meat is sold at retail specifically, what would you like to, what would you want that to look like? What do you want to see there?
Oh, man. Well, if I could make a wave of magic wand, it would start in Washington with policy.
Yeah.
Okay. So much of this goes back to this system, mm-hmm. right? This, you know, we talk about the complex, right? This complex mm-hmm. that is, big pharma, big chemical, big ag, big petroleum, all funding what is in their own best interests. And they all have an interest in the food supply and the farming system and these bills that spend hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars to perpetuate the status quo. Mm-hmm. And to create research and reporting that is, beneficial and curated, and to slow down the sort of progress that we're trying to make. Right. Mm-hmm. I think the people on the land, and I think the consumers would be happy to support the system if it was as more available than it is, because it's currently kind of kept down. I think the perfect supply though, in the grocery store wouldn't be markedly different than it is. You know what I mean? It'd be like animals origining from their same original location, right? You know, like, well, I'd say one, we would have more animals, more ruminant animals on more land, right? I think we have something like 2 billion, not quite 2 billion acres of land here. Animals are on a small percentage of it. They could be on a very, very large percentage of it. A lot of it is cropland, which is not, you know, roughly 900 million or more acres of cropland, which isn't really getting the benefit of animal impact and historically would have had it and needs it. So I would see that being incorporated. I would see the celebration of animals and the services that they perform as a part of those systems. I would see the true acknowledgement of the heroic efforts of these nameless and faceless people who live every day suffering to feed our population and not being overlooked and insulted and discredited for the fact that they work the land for us. And I'd see those numbers growing and access to that as a worthy pursuit and profession growing as well. I think you'd see the story behind the food and the system better represented in the grocery store. If it's a good system, we shouldn't need to veil the truth and it shouldn't be concealed. And if it's a good system, you know, again, going back to my prior comments, right? If it's good, you want to show it. So they should love to talk about their supply chains and share videos and stories and be transparent and, you know, and authentic with how and what they're actually doing. And I don't think it should only be my standard, right? I mean, again, we have different people and different geographies and different socioeconomic backgrounds that prefer or need and require different things. But I would argue if we change the system, we address the cost issue, right? We level that playing field almost instantaneously. And if we look at true value, there's nothing more valuable and less costly than these systems. So I think that kind of works itself out in the wash in time as we get there. But I would envision, you know, again, us adjusting ultimately and put more shortly, our food production systems, plant and animal, should be operating in harmony with nature. We should be putting out more pounds of food per acre. We should be positively impacting more acres of land. We'd be addressing all the things that we're concerned about. We'd be feeding more people more nutrient rich food. And we'd, you know, these global catastrophes that we're all, you know, the news is constantly fear mongering to us would begin to be mitigated, because most of it point back to agriculture.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned positive impact on the land, and previously you had mentioned with the Saver EOV certification and some of your other field testing that you measure your partner ranches, you know, soil organic matter levels, water infiltration rates. Do you have any stories at the top of your head of that, you know, a ranch that's been a partner ranch for X number of years where you can say like, you know, we've seen their soil organic matter increase from X to Y, or do you have any of those like metrics offhand that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few examples. You know, I think I'll give two. The first is, you know, in our days at Epic, and we talked about General Mills, and with their support, we funded a life cycle assessment at in Georgia at White Oak Pastures. Several hundred thousand dollars. These are not inexpensive tests. And we used an organization called Quantis Laboratories, which is the same research group that Impossible Foods used to do their life cycle assessment. And a life cycle assessment is supposed to be a beginning to end look at the carbon impact, the greenhouse gas or carbon equivalent impact of a system. And I think if you look at conventional agriculture, you know, beef is almost 20 plus pounds of carbon per pound of beef produced, and pork and poultry are upwards of 10 pounds per pound produced, and corn and soy and crops are, you know, 6 pounds per pound. And, you know, Impossible Foods and Beyond Burger claim that for every pound of sludge they make, they only emit three and a half to four pounds of carbon equivalents into the atmosphere. So it's, which is hilarious, because like by their own standard, they're still emitting more carbon than they're impacting. So they can maybe make the claim that it's less bad, but again, they make a lot of claims that are totally absolutely bogus. But the life cycle assessment we did at White Oak Pastures showed, you know, we thought it was important to do that because we can see anecdotally the progress. We can see more plants and diversity and species returning and topsoil building and water infiltration rates improving. We hadn't done this level of analysis. And what it showed at White Oak was, in this example, in this context of regenerative agriculture, that they could sequester 3.5 pounds of carbon and carbon equivalents out of the atmosphere, store it in the soil, and do that for every pound of protein, of beef protein that they produced. And so the easy way to take all of that science and turn it into something that that I figured out consumers more readily understood is, I would always say, in order to offset the carbon of eating an Impossible burger, you need to eat one regenerative beef burger, which is pretty badass, right? And I think in that research, we did a lot of other stuff in that research, like, you know, White Oak Pastures improved their soil organic matter levels like 300% in the first 5 years. The soil nutrition improved, water infiltration rates improved, they're growing topsoil. Wow. Again, they're addressing all these issues, right? Bringing native species back, like in the bald eagle in their case. So really, really cool, really expensive, very formal, very scientific, et cetera. I think other examples, and there's many of them, but just to make it maybe bring it a little closer to home and personal for you guys, you both have been out to Rome Ranch, done field harvests and tours. And, you know, it's funny that in a few short years, you know, that operation as well has seen all of the same things. Soil organic matter improve dramatically, hundreds of percent. Infiltration rates, systems, species, biomass, all the stuff that you would look at and say, hey, is this a healthy land base, getting better and better after having been conventionally farmed for many years? And in some of the fields that y'all toured, you know, 3-4 years ago, we would say, oh my God, look at this, is like a desert and this is why. Yeah. And now we have to show photos of what it looked like, because it's hard to provide context where something looks healthy to say, no, like you have to understand where this was 2 years ago. And so I think, you know, you see springs getting, you know, aquifers being more charged, springs starting to have water flow again, like Audubon Society going nuts over bird populations showing up in these areas, researchers wanting to come out and do that kind of stuff. And, it's really, really cool. And there's tons and tons, like everywhere somebody's adopted regenerative, there's an example like that, right?
Yeah. It can be really overwhelming as a consumer. And one thing I always recommend to people that changed my life is just go to a farm, go to a ranch. Like, I had a pretty transformational experience at Rep Provisions in Oklahoma, which is another Savory accredited, Savory hub. And Eric planted organic corn right next to traditional diverse perennial grasses. Right. And like, one was way better than the other. And it was still good organic corn, like great, you know, and it's not all crop agriculture is bad, but it's more so just like, even with all the data, which is great and we need it, as human beings, we've just lost total connection to food. And go to do that one place. Like, I've been to White Oak, I've been to Rome Ranch, I've been to Rep Provisions or all these other places, and your senses aren't going to lie to you. Like, you're going to see, okay, this place is living in balance with the natural systems that is supposed to be in this ecosystem.
Yeah, totally. And I think if you can do that, absolutely. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I think going back to greenwashing, like, there's a lot of people that say they grass feed, that therefore say they're regenerative. And even, I mean,
yeah,
I will always support community and local, right? But local isn't always better. I think we just need to be careful. I think generally we should be supporting our communities. I just want to make sure that the people in our communities we're supporting are the right ones and the ones that are good actors and doing what they can to be part of a solution besides just being closer. Besides just having a more common zip code, which is relevant, but it's not everything. I forget where I was going with that. You just made a point. Remind me, sorry.
Some people can't afford to go do that. Is that where you're going with it?
Right. Yeah. You know, I think, or they're not that interested, or they don't have the time, or they don't, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's like, so how do we, again, that's like, how do we make that hurdle smaller? Well, we go to those places and we tell their stories and we create videos and we share that content. We raise awareness and create experience and the next most convenient way, which is in the digital realm, or hopefully in a grocery store, in a restaurant. And again, try to reach people where they are. Maybe we can inspire more to go onto the land. Again, this should not be a substitute for that, but you know, we may be talking about a few single digit percentage points, the number of people that can or will go visit. We're looking at 100 times, you know, dozens of times that at least, that will check it out online and maybe get inspired to become more and more, committed, which is what we're trying to do. And we talk about that too. Mm-hmm. And really like what we're trying to do. You know, I have said from the beginning and will continue to say, I think the best way to source meat is not necessarily force of nature. We're a great way to source meat, but we're not at the top, right? I think the best way to source your meat is, frankly, I think personally, my opinion, it's to put on a backpack and to get into the mountains and hook around and haul shit and suffer and try not to get chewed up by the terrain or the animals that are looking to chew you up and fail, you know, and suffer and struggle and not succeed, and recognizing how challenging it is to feed yourself and then to do it again and succeed and feel the reward of a successful hunt, but also the complex emotions that come with taking a life and an appreciation for that life you have and a respect for that life that you have, and frankly, a relationship that you have formed through that trial and through that transition that will manifest into a different experience as you eat it, as you savor it and share it and think of it as a life and not a product in a styrofoam package. I think that's at the top of the list, right? I think second is to either be a regenerative farmer and, you know, have your own regenerative ranch and be growing and producing your own food, or to be next door neighbors to one. That's the form of local, I'd say, all day, every day. You go support them over us. And if they have everything you need, they're doing it right, and they're next door, like by all means. I think that those two things, while fantastic, are not as accessible to everybody. And if we really want to drive change at scale, and we really want to recognize that, you know, this population largely lives in the Northeast and in the far West. There are massive groups of people that have barriers between them and those points. And really, that's what force of nature is here for, right? Like, how do we provide the next best solution, supporting these regenerative ranches all over the country and these smaller regional food systems, but doing it at a national scale, doing the education, doing the hard work and validation and sourcing, trying to make it tee it up where it's convenient and easy. You know, that's where we fit, I think, in the hierarchy of sourcing food, which I still think is light years beyond the existing food system and the overwhelming majority of what even the most well-intentioned consumers are supporting and complicit in supporting and have access to. That, I think, is like one of the more underlying sad tragedies, right? Where you have people that intend to do good and unknowingly are complicit in perpetuating a system that's entirely the opposite. Golly, that makes me upset to think about the taking advantage of the good intentions of people at a premium.
Yeah,
it's such a good point, you know, and I'll fully own this. No, you mentioned the merger earlier, 2015, 2016 era. Trying to explain the regenerative concept to General Mills and all the pushback you were getting, right? And I watched Cowspiracy during that time period. I was like, whoa, I got to stop consuming red meat because I've been fed this narrative that, you know, red meat is bad for the planet. And so I didn't eat beef for 3 years. Then I learned about regenerative and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so powerful. It's not only like a don't do any harm, this is a do good and support life by choosing this form of protein, which is just super powerful. And it's a huge paradigm shift. So to your point about consumers trying to pay for a premium to do the right thing, they're just being fed the wrong information. So we super appreciate you taking the time to hop on this podcast and to explain to everybody who's listening, like, this is the truth behind how your food is made and the type of impact it can make for both the planet and your health, et cetera. But on that note, I want to touch a little bit on the future. So you mentioned all the different types of protein that Force Mains is working with
right now. May I make one? I'm sorry to interrupt, but may I add one point on that before we transition? I just think it's interesting. Yeah. On the health and being everybody being pushed in that way, right? I mean, again, our origin is in a vegan energy bar company. So like we're no exception. And I think most of the paleo leaders and keto leaders and even the carnivore influencers were all generally many were vegans at one point for this reason. They were trying to be tip of the spear. They were going out of their way to make conscious effort to do the best thing that they could do for their own health and wellness and for the impact on a broader group of stakeholders from land to welfare of animals and so on. They were fed the same lies that you were before ending up on the path that they're on now because that system failed them. Whether it's the vegan myth and propaganda machine or the vegetarianism, it tends to often than not lead to health decline and challenge. And frankly, it perpetuates the system of the status quo. It doesn't offer solutions. It's a misdirection at best. And if you look at the population of people that are vegan, it hasn't changed because once you get there, folks are pushed there rapidly, but leave pretty quickly because it proves hollow in terms of its ability to actually produce the intended results. And so I just want to, you know, just take that moment to push like, hey, it is fundamentally, it is not healthier. You know, everybody's different but by and large and generally, you know, that is a myth. That is a lie. That is a misconception. And that, you know, again, you guys have probably had other guests on here that could really get into the health and nutrition of meat. We should all have meat coming from regenerative systems as a cornerstone of our diet. And the last thing I'll say on it, which is kind of the main point I wanted to drive to there is it's so common. Everybody, you're nodding your heads because you know the same stories, right? I mean, this is the second company that I've been, a third company I've been a part of where the founders were vegan and transitioned over to, you know, paleo and carnivore because of the health impacts of being vegan. But you always hear that story. You always hear people trying veganism and trying vegetarianism and it causing issues and then reverting to a paleo, keto, carnivore type lifestyle. You never hear the alternative. You never hear somebody like truly following consistent the guidelines of those diets that incorporate healthy animal proteins, having issues and then reverting to vegetarian or veganism and those issues improving, right? That doesn't exist. That should tell you a lot. I mean, if you're looking for evidence, I'd say anecdotally, there's a lot of evidence there. So sorry, Kyle, for interrupting. I just really want to drive that point.
I think it's a really great point. Well, and just to expand on that a little bit, I think that's because the general arc is, you know, status quo, like all meat is the same is where people start, right? And then they end up like, okay, I want to get better source. And instead of identifying like the nuance between regular conventionally raised meat and high quality regenerative meat, they just choose to disregard meat in general, like I did, even though it's just beef, just red meat, you know, because that's the easier option to make. It's easier to make that distinction to your point of like the burden the consumers face of like having to understand these really complex systems about who is making their food and how. That's just the easier way to go. But then the art comes back to well sourced meat instead of just like status quo meat, right? And I think that's the difference. If we took people who wanted to like make those healthy, conscious decisions and take the first part of the journey out of the equation where they don't go straight to plant-based, they can focus on regenerative first, I think we're going to see better health outcomes, better planetary outcomes faster than, you know, pushing people towards plant-based right off the rip. But where I was trying to go was what's the future hold for Force of Nature? You have done some incredible work. Are you looking to expand more, you know, protein types, expand acreage, increase penetration into different channels? Like, what are the goals for Force of Nature in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a goals perspective, one of our major goals is to facilitate the creation of a global regenerative supply network, right? Mm. So create more incentive and more opportunity for folks on producers and ranchers and farmers to adopt or convert to regenerative practices. Generally speaking, you do that by creating more and more demand for the, mm-hmm. you know, the output, the yield off of those lands. And so similarly, more and more consumers selecting for, sending demand signals for, stirring that economic engine for more and more regenerative production, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's our objective. We say, you know, from a legacy goals perspective, we want to see regenerative become a household concept, much as organic is today. And we say that we want to, create, you know, through our performance success, modeling a successful path that this can be done successfully, it can be done profitably, it can be done in a way that honors what the consumer is looking for, but also what the land and the broader group of stakeholders need and the farmers and ranchers need. Prove that out and create a massive ripple effect that opens the door for others like us, and that forces the hand of the large incumbents, right? Again, kind of going back to how change happens at scale. And if we can create acceleration and the generation of even more momentum towards making these changes, we'll put these large companies on notice. Okay, this isn't work. Cutting this corner isn't working anymore. It's getting called out. There's more visibility into it. We have to step up our game when we can really start to drive change at scale. And so whatever we can do to accomplish those things is on the table for us.
Mm-hmm. Love that. You've been answering this final question the whole time we've been talking to you, and it's a beautiful symphony so far. So I'm curious what your final note's going to be. But to put a hard quant on it, how do we get regen brands to have 50% market share by 2050? What are some specific things there?
Oh man, that's a simple answer though. That's the shortest answer I have yet. It's the consumer.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that, you know, we live in this country here where we think that we can be frustrated by something like we vote, right? We can be disappointed in our political system and not feel that either side of the two primary options represent truly what we are, you know, believe and feel and value. Mm-hmm. And so we abstain, right? We just don't vote. You can see it at the polls. That's sort of been our reaction to the things that frustrate us and disappoint us. We can't do that with our food system. You know, to the extent that we are eating or purchasing or consuming anything that we're buying and not producing ourselves on our own land, which is all of us to a large degree, you know, we're actively sending signals to support a system. Mm-hmm. And right now that consistently historically has been supporting the system that I think is counter to our values. It's the industrial system. It's the commodity system. It's the system that's creating these challenges that generally we all express concerns with. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think in order to see 50% of our food convert to regenerative and I think our definition and standard for regenerative is sort of what we've been talking about today, not what that might be or mean in 2050. I think we're talking about the intent here, not the semantics.
Yeah.
I think the intent is land, a food that is coming from land that's helping that land be more resilient, be better habitat, be more self-sustaining, produce more nutrient-dense food, produce more food, preserve this incredible landscape of wilderness and wonderment and fertility. That has gifted us the opportunity that we have today, right? That's really what we're going for. I think the consumer holds all the cards. Nobody will produce a product a consumer won't buy. You stop buying the product on the shelf right now, they're going to stop producing it. And so, you know, the consumers wield the most awesome weapon of all. You know, it's their choice. It's their advocacy. It's their desire to wake up and participate in being a part of the solution. And I know it seems hard and changing consumer behavior is tough, but I think in this instance, it's not changing behavior. It's just creating awareness with the understanding and belief that when consumers have access to that information, they're going to choose differently. And you see this all through human history, revolutions, the existence of the country that we live in today with the rights and opportunities we have was the result of people standing up for being, you know, mistreated and taken advantage of. And so between now and 2050, yeah, sure, there's a lot of details. There's people and process, practice and legislation and supply chains. There's a lot of, there's complication to it. But at the end of the day, that stuff is readily solvable and it works itself out when there's a reason, and consumers are all of the reason. If we can keep consumers misled, dumb, blinded to the reality around them, being complicit, trusting what's convenient, ignoring the obvious signs that any level of critical thinking would demonstrate to them that there's an issue here, you know, we can maintain the status quo and perpetuate the system through 2050. Not much longer, though, because there is a cliff that we're racing towards. And this is finite. We're abusing and taking advantage of these systems to the extent where we will exhaust them. And then we will truly have a global crisis and tragedy, not for the planet, because the planet will go on without us, but our place on it changes dramatically when we can't feed ourselves. But again, between now and 2050, if the consumer, if more people become more aware and there becomes more access and more opportunity, to support these systems, I think they can be not just 50% by 2050. I think they can be more. And I think at some point, some way, shape, or form, not only is it possible, it's necessary. Because again, our current system is plagued and riddled with catastrophes that it is creating and we are racing towards if we don't change. So to me, there's sort of an illusion of choice here, right? It's like we pretend that, like, can we make this change by 2050 or whatever date you choose? It's like, no, we don't really have. It's not really a choice. It's like either we make the change or we're fucked. And so, you know, that's sort of where I'm at on that is, like, I'm going to do everything I can to give people the power of choice, awareness. And I call it awareness and access. And I think that will yield the outcome we're looking for if us and others continue to succeed at doing this.
Mm. Love that answer. You know, Anthony mentioned the symphony and the final note. That was spot on. Like, the empowerment it gives consumers. I love the correlation to a revolution, and it's just a really cool idea. And I couldn't agree more. I think that you're spot on. You know, consumers have to make the choice. And again, that kind of circles back to why we're here doing this podcast, right? To spread the word, to spread the gospel, to showcase the incredible work that you and other regenerative brands are doing, to make it easier for those to understand the complicated nuance that regenerative agriculture is.
Yeah, I think, I think the truth too, is I don't mean to disparage anybody, right? I think most consumers will support. I just don't think they've had access to the information. They haven't known.
Right.
You know, so I don't want to come across as belittling consumers who don't agree with me. More along the lines of as they get more awareness and as they gain a better understanding and appreciation for the truth behind their food, that is the more of that occurs, more momentum and more demand signaling towards better food systems. Right. And so, you know, if somebody hasn't been aware and they've been victims of a system designed to keep them in the dark. You know, I don't fault them for that, but we're trying to turn the lights on. And from there forward, it's the opportunities in their hands to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Man, thank you so much for joining us, man. When you're ready to run for president, you got my vote.
Oh God. I think it takes a special kind of person to want that job. And I am not putting my name in the hat.
maybe USDA, maybe the head of the USDA or something like that.
We start there. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the kind words and confidence. I think I got my work cut out for me here at Force of Nature right now, but but we'll see how things go and then we'll go from there.
Well, thank you so much for making the time, man. This is great. We're so excited to share with our audience, and just thanks so much.
Yeah. Appreciate you both. Again, consumers can't do their job and I can't do my job without folks like y'all giving us this platform and this opportunity to share the message and begin to create some of that awareness that leads to the change we all want to see manifested in the world. So great job, guys. And thank you.
Appreciate that. One team, one dream, you know?
Yep, exactly. For show notes, episode transcripts, and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also find our Regen Recaps on the website. Regen Recaps take less than 5 minutes to read and cover all the key points of the full hour-long conversations. You can check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, subscribe to future episodes, and share the show with your friends. Thanks for tuning in to the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode, and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.